We ethnomusicologists are fond of banding about terms like mass-mediated culture, musical community, and identity. Lately, I've become interested in music and cultural memory and the role of recorded and mass-mediated musics in this. Of course, popular music has generated a great deal of scholarship, as has the issue of the diverse definitions of musical community. In looking at music and American cultural memory, I want to zero in on a few specific things here today that have perhaps been overlooked. Local mass media, local cultural identity in memory, and the role of the singing commercial or jingle in all of this. We're in Cleveland, Ohio, my hometown. Although I've not lived here for almost 30 years, I grew up here, still have family here, visit often, still identify myself as a Clevelander, although at the time I lived here, I considered myself to be somewhat of a cultural outsider. However, when I meet fellow Clevelanders, we generally have certain things in common, a specific way of speaking, or the Cleveland accent, sports teams, neighborhoods, landmarks like the Terminal Tower, now known as Tower City, and local products like Carling Black Label Beer, a sponsor of the Cleveland Indians, or Cotton Club soft drinks. Depending upon the generation, we may remember certain local television shows like Captain Penny, Barnaby, certain radio stations like Wixie 1260 and WMMS, and disc jockeys, although I admit I was a rebellious folkie who preferred to play guitar than listen to the radio. We also have another shared local mass-mediated reference. Here's a story. When I enrolled in graduate school in ethnomusicology at UCLA in 1999, there were 13 of us in the incoming class. When we went around the room and introduced ourselves, two of us were from the same hometown, Lakewood, Ohio, the first suburb west of Cleveland. Since I went to graduate school later in life after a couple of other careers, my classmate was exactly 20 years younger than I. He'd grown up down the street from where my brother now lives on Lake Road. We talked a little about the Cleveland Indians and some landmarks, but soon got busy with schoolwork and forgot about it. One afternoon, when we were in the ethno lab listening to field recordings for an assignment in bibliography class, Brad and I happened to be sitting next to each other, each with our own set of earphones. I decided the time was right. I motioned for Brad to take off his earphone, and I leaned over and sang into his ear. Someone near you knows the one, the only patio enclosures. Okay, I didn't have a cold at the time. Immediately, his eyes widened, and he looked at me, and he said, "Oh, my God, it's you." I was the voice Brad had heard his entire life. Yes, I am the voice of the most often and longest played, and with my apologies to the composer who's sitting here, the most inescapable and therefore eventually annoying jingle in Cleveland. My moment of greatness is actually about 20 seconds of greatness played over and over and over for 30 years. By the way, it was a buyout, which means they paid once. Daddy will tell you about buyouts later. No residuals, and thanks, I think I made $70 for that. This story is to illustrate the point of my paper. Music and cultural memory, and the singing jingle. More specifically, local community, local soundscape, and local cultural memory through local mass media. Before the time of the great American community, with McDonald's and Starbucks and Cinnabon, there were, in fact, local communities. To the broadcast media and advertising world, these were known as local markets. Just as local products are part of a local community identity, so are the singing jingles used to sell them. Today, singing jingles are still a large part of our everyday soundscape and cultural memory. Of course, this is by design, and there are several reasons for this, including the power of music, the construction of the successful jingle, and the often overlooked, far-reaching power of radio. Today, I'll go into a quick history of radio advertising and the singing commercial or jingle. Then I'll talk a bit about local markets and the golden age of the local jingle. And finally, I'll turn it all over to my guest, Dick Woolley, who worked for decades as a successful commercial composer here in Cleveland. He'll tell you about his background and career as a composer in Cleveland, and together we'll go through some examples of his work, sharing some stories. The first radio commercial was broadcast in 1922 by New York's WEAF. The first singing commercial was broadcast in 1926 and was for a product. Can anybody hazard a guess what kind of product the first singing jingle was for?
Cereal?
Yes, Wheaties. Ooh, we have a winner. Who said that? All right. All right. In early radio, there were national network programs, just as with television today. However, when television burst on the scene in the 50s, radio was at first impacted negatively until it transformed itself. It became the medium for local and regional programming, like local news, weather, local sporting events, and looked to local advertising for revenue. This local advertising became as much a part of the soundscape and character of local radio as the programming itself, and this brought about the golden age of the local jingle. A clever or catchy jingle could become as popular as a hit song, and that prospect was seductive to potential advertisers and the stuff that drove the jingle industry. There are several reasons why a radio jingle can be powerfully effective. First, let's look at the objectives of a jingle. One, to sell the product. But in order to do that, the consumer must become familiar with the product and remember the name of the product and make positive associations with it. However, the most important thing is to remember the name of the product. Radio is a perfect medium for these goals. Radio is played in public places, in the workplace, and more than 90% of cars now have radios. Consumers have reported listening to radio to alleviate loneliness or boredom. Radio is virtually unavoidable, and once it is encountered, it is almost impossible to completely ignore. Further, radio is intimate. It speaks directly to the individual. At its most effective, it takes advantage of the greatest weapon in its arsenal, the imagination. Whereas television supplies a visual, radio has been called the most visual of all media because the visual is supplied by the imagination of the individual listener, creating a deeper, more personal connection and personal memory. Okay, in case you're skeptical about all of this premise, I'd like to see how much shared cultural memory we have here. We don't have a big crowd, but I think we'll do all right since that Wheaties answer. Here is the list published by the Advertising Age magazine, the primary journal of the advertising industry, of the top 10 jingles of the 20th century. Let's see how we identify ourselves by our shared cultural memory of these. I have sound clips for some, and I have confidence that we can supply sound for others, except some of the really old ones. And if you know the really old ones, don't be ashamed to sing them. I'm going to save Pepsi for last, because it's kind of interesting. You'll find out why. So can we sing the first one? Anybody sing the first one? You deserve a break today. So get up and get away. Yeah. Okay. Be all that you can be. You can do it. Yes, we can do it all right. Okay, we're going to skip Pepsi. And then anybody know the next one? Good. Good. That's what Campbell soups are. Good. Okay, we don't all know each other, but we have this shared cultural memory, and we might be getting hungry, too. The next one.
See the USA in your Chevrolet.
Okay, great. See if you can identify this singer. Oh, you. There she is. That's Dinah. Listen to what you're imagining. Imagine all the places you can go if you buy a Chevrolet. Isn't that amazing? Okay, we all know this one. Let's just have a sing-along, shall we? And let's see what we are imagining we are here and why this works for kids, and it's so silly.
Oh, I wish I were an Oscar Mayer wiener.
That's what I truly like to be. 'Cause if I were an Oscar Mayer wiener, everyone would be in love with me.
Those kids' parents were so excited to get them that gig, weren't they? Okay. And then look at this for what you're imagining. I don't have a sound clip for it, but we can do it. Double your pleasure. Now just imagine, this is your personal pleasure you're doubling, right? Double your pleasure, double your fun. How are you going to double that? With doublemint, doublemint, doublemint gum. Yes, your pleasure and fun will be doubled with gum. And here's one that tells us what a cigarette should taste like, and if you're cool, your cigarette does. Yes, you beat me to it. You already know the tune, right? It's a catchy tune.
Good like a cigarette should.
Listen to this hook.
Winston tastes good like a cigarette should. Winston gives you real flavor.
And hear that cool rock and roll guitar? That's for youth culture to be smoking cigarettes. Here's my very favorite of them all. This one lets you know how you can get women. 1940s.
Another public service announcement from Brill Cream. Men, beware. Use one dab of Brill Cream. Just a little dab makes your hair look excitingly clean, disturbingly healthy. This man dared to use two dabs. Now he's in trouble. We refuse to be responsible.
Radio.
Brill Cream,
Brill Cream,
Brill Cream.
Brill Cream, a little dab will do ya. Brill Cream, you look so debonair. Brill Cream, the gals will all pursue ya. They'll love to get their fingers in your hair. Brill Cream, a little dab will do ya.
I had to play the whole thing, it's just so cool.
Get Brill Cream today.
In the end, get Brill Cream today. Okay, now I have a little montage here. The one they chose was Pepsi-Cola hits the spot. I skipped Coke because I'm going to do colas anyhow. And the cola campaigns are very similar in what they do. I have a little montage of a sampling of four different Pepsi-Cola commercials throughout the generations. And listen to how they're trying to guide our imagination and cause us to identify with the product, need the product to identify. Can you sing this one? That's the first one.
Pepsi Cola, it's the spot. 12 full ounces, that's a lot. Twice as much for
anybody remember this?
Pepsi Cola is the drink for you. Nickel, 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 nickel.
Pepsi Cola hits the spot. 12 full
ounces. It's cooler now for the next generation.
Twice as much for a nickel, too. Pepsi Cola is the drink for you.
Listen how she describes who you are.
Come alive, come alive.
I think they should have chosen this one.
You're in the Pepsi generation. Come alive, come alive.
It's got caffeine, you do come alive.
Pepsi generation.
And here's who you are.
Drink light, drink great, drink right up to date. Young taste, young drive, young face, come alive.
Young taste, young drive, young
come alive,
face, come alive.
Come alive. You're in the Pepsi generation. You're in the Pepsi generation.
Anybody know who this is? I thought I hit all the generations here.
You're a whole new generation.
Now he's commenting on the every household word, Pepsi generation. She doesn't even need to say it. Here it is. What? He's giving Pepsi to a whole new generation, isn't he? Okay. Let's look at a couple of these and how they lead the imagination. Simple ones we skipped. We talked about that. Now, where do people listen to radio? That's in the car, you're in traffic, you're at work. That's where people generally hear the radio. You deserve a break today. From what? Where? Okay. So get up and get away to this fabulous place. Boom. the product, McDonald's, okay? Be all that you can be, all that you personally imagine yourself to be. You can do it. You're empowered. Where? In the Army. Okay. Oops, I went the wrong way. Okay. Of course, there are several kinds of successful jingles that make use of imagination. There's straight imagination like Chevy that takes you across the countryside. You have American freedom if you have a Chevy. Gimmick jingles that promote a fun feeling and a possible silly visual, like Oscar Mayer. Those that promote a sense of identity or belonging through the use of a product, you're cool and sexy like Brill Cream and Coke and Pepsi. And finally, when in doubt, the safest answer is always repetition of the product name, preferably in a clever way. Okay, let's get local. Cleveland has long had the identity of a hardworking, working-class town. We like our rock hard and classic. We like our sports teams winning, and we're pretty outspoken about it when they are not. Situated on the North Coast, Lake Erie, right between New York and Chicago, Cleveland has maintained its own distinct cultural identity, although like most places, this is becoming more and more challenged. However, until the mid-1980s or so, Cleveland had many local products that it was proud to support. As my guest composer will tell you, however, it still suffered from lack of self-esteem in the shadow of New York and Chicago in many ways. So on the one hand, the period of the 60s and 70s was a good time to be a composer of local radio jingles. But on the other hand, because of certain attitudes, it was more challenging than you might think. Still, like most jingle composers with important and heavily disseminated campaigns like Cotton Club, the City of Cleveland, and the opening music for the WEWS Channel 5 television news, various other local clients like Patio Enclosures, Dick Woolley is a skilled composer whose music is a significant yet often overlooked part of the soundscape of his local market, Cleveland, Ohio, during a specific period of time. K. Richard Woolley was born in Marion, Ohio, earned a bachelor's degree in music from Ohio Wesleyan University and a master's degree in music from Case Western Reserve University. A jazz trombonist and arranger, he's been a working musician since he was about 12 when older musicians went away to World War II. He led the campus dance band in college, was a band director at Case, and taught music in Shaker Heights in a junior high school. He then started his own custom recording business, another fascinating paper topic, recording local and regional schools. He was promoted to an executive position in the pressing and manufacturing company Century Records that made the records for the local schools. However, he felt too far removed from the musical aspect, so he began a serious career as a musician, arranger, conductor, and composer in Cleveland. Although his career as a jingle composer waned with the shift in the industry in the 80s and 90s, he continued to work composing music for industrial films and SeaWorld. Currently, he has come full circle to return to playing his trombone in local jazz clubs. I'll ask him to begin by giving you a bit of his history in his own words, and then we'll look at some of his more memorable and representative work, touching on issues raised by specific pieces. Before we do, how many Clevelanders do we have here? Okay, so you may recognize some of these. Okay, this is my dad, Dick Woolley.
Thank you. I'm old, so if it's all right with you, I'm going to sit down, all right? I often get calls from aspiring musicians, and thank you, Amy, who'd like to get into the jingle business. My answer is always much the same. You need a reasonable degree of talent and a lot of luck. Working in music advertising is quite like working in fashion. The only people who seem to succeed are those who have already proven their success, and in the case of music, that's something that's been bought and played on the air. A huge problem for those getting started. How you get a chance for this is wide open, but it's virtually always accidental. My break came when an ad executive, Peggy Miller, with Ludwig Advertising here in town, Lustig Advertising, came to see a show that I'd put on at Woodbury Junior High School in Shaker Heights, where I was teaching. This was in 1958 or 59. She somehow felt I might have the creativity or whatever that might work for her major account, the Cotton Club Bottling Company, large local Cleveland area bottler that bottles Schweppes and RC Cola and other name brands and their own line of sodas. I began writing music and collaborating with Peggy and got my education and the basics as she and her boss at Cotton Club, Wilton Kahn, dictated them. They insisted on several unquestioned rules. The product name must predominate over all else, repeated often and clearly. The production costs should be kept real low. Humor, whenever it's used at all, should be done very, very carefully. The spot should withstand the heavy, repeated, and long-term airplay usage they employed. And perhaps lastly, the music style should be appropriate and well done. This becomes a question of priorities, which for a person who considers himself something of an artist had to be learned hard for me, as it would be, I think, for many musicians. The music is not the main goal that goes on here. It's the people that sign the check and people that pay the money to put it on the air that really dictate what goes on here. It's a matter of priorities. My favorite story about priorities was I played in pit orchestras here in town, and Bert Lahr came into town with a new show called Foxy. This was in the mid-50s, and I was the young guy in the Hanna Pit Orchestra. That's our local legitimate theater, or was for years. Now been reopened partially at least. And we rehearsed the score, and it was the score was by Eddie Sauter, who had a wonderful band, the Sauter Finnegan Orchestra, in the 50s. It was very, very creative. It wasn't the standard big band. They did a lot of cute things. They played kazoos, but it was more than novelty. It was very, very musical. So Eddie had done a very interesting score, very cute score. And we worked on it, had a lot of fun learning to play the thing, and then came the day for the stars to come in, and all of it went very well up until when Bert Lahr came in. You all know who Bert Lahr was, the lion in The Wizard of Oz. He was an old vaudevillian. He knew what was important. He knew what priorities were going to work. We started to play down through his very first number, and it was a soft shoe thing, kind of like the tempo of "What's in Love." What's the "Once in Love with Amy"?
I was named for that song.
What?
I said I was named for that song.
Yes, right. and it was just fine. It was a very cute arrangement, except that Eddie, instead of using what we call fills, the things that the musicians play at the end of a musical phrase to kind of fill in while the singer takes a breath. Instead of using ensembles, he used solo instruments. So Bert sang his first phrase, and the piccolo did a little doodly-boop, bloop, 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 and sang his next phrase, and I was playing a thing called a trombone. It was supposed to be a baritone horn, but I didn't have one. I had a trombone. And I played my little doodly-loop, and about the third or fourth of these things, Bert began to get a very, very dark frown on his face. He didn't like that at all. So about the fifth or sixth that he heard, he reached up and touched the conductor, and he says, "Conductor, I'm going to ask you, who's going to be funny in this damn show, me or the orchestra?" So he says, "We're going to circle some things. If you haven't played in a pit orchestra, maybe you don't know. Circle means leave it out. You count the time, but you leave that part out. So we're going to circle some things," saying the first phrase. The piccolo player said, did her thing, and he said, "Circle that." And I did, and it turned out my part had about a whole bunch of these things. And I'm new to the orchestra. I'm still in my mid-20s. It's a long time ago. And pretty nervous and not real happy with having to play this trombonium anyhow. So about the fourth or fifth one of these things that he told me to circle, I'm cringing. I want to get below the seat, you know. And he looked over and he saw how dismayed I was. And he says, "Son, circle your chair." Broke everybody up, and we had a good time thereafter. Anyhow, all I'm suggesting to you is that was one of my first lessons in priorities. And so maybe that's what helped me when it came to doing jingles. Let's play a few that I did for Cotton Club.
Anybody in here remember the Cotton Club soft drinks? You may remember these. These were some of the first ones that Daddy did, and I remember hearing them as a kid in the house. I loved the Hillbilly Juice one. I now teach Appalachian music. Little did I realize that maybe I was inspired by Hillbilly Juice. You never know. I don't think so, but maybe. This is one that's gimmicky, and I'll just have a list here so that we can multitask and listen at the same time. This is a montage that will play Hillbilly Juice. Here's the can right here. Look at that. Holy cow. And then it's going to go to Cherokee Red, and then Cotton Club Ginger Ale. When we get to Cotton Club Ginger Ale, the name of that was, the point of that was the name of the product, and how many times can you say it? So we're going to count how many times they say the product name. But here we go. Here's the Cotton Club campaign.
All the folks is acting coy. They is proud, they is hoi polloi.
Since the word got spread around, 'twas here that hillbilly juice was found.
Hillbilly juice.
Hillbilly juice.
Sweet flowing nectar. Hillbilly juice.
Those are famous disc jockeys in town.
Cherokee, Cherokee, Cherokee Red,
Cherokee Red,
Cherokee Red Pop,
Cherokee Red Pop,
wahoo, wahee, drink Cherokee, Cherokee,
Cherokee,
Cherokee Red,
Cherokee Red,
Cherokee Red,
the layering of the name.
Cherokee's right out of sight. Get together with Cotton Club, and whenever there's real ginger ale to make out, it's Cotton Club, less sweet ginger ale. Oh!
Good food, a party mood, and Cotton Club, less sweet ginger ale, Cotton Club sparkling club soda, and fabulous 50-50 make for a holiday happening. Stock up now with Cotton Club.
Less sweet means fewer calories. It's best by every test. Real ginger from Jamaica in Cotton Club. Cotton Club.
Cotton Club. Get together with Cotton Club. Party magic with real ginger from Jamaica in Cotton Club. Less sweet ginger ale.
11 repetitions of Cotton Club. You couldn't mistake it. And they bought so much airtime. Everybody was singing this thing in town here, I think.
He had to do an arrangement of it for local marching bands to do, of the Cotton Club thing.
That's right, I did.
And our band did it at Lakewood High.
So I slowly assembled a portfolio working on this account over several years, began trying to get other work, and I quickly learned about Cleveland advertising agencies, and that is to say that this is a meat and potatoes industrial town, and our agencies were not especially strong in retail, meaning they had relatively little media work, and when they did, they went to New York or Chicago or other large production centers. I and other local producers, at the time, Al Balo and Walt Woodward, had only modest success finding work here. Well, Woodward, by the way, wrote a book called An Insider's Guide to Advertising Music, which is out of print. I never read it, but if you're interested in this subject, you might want to try to find that. I saw it on eBay at $74 used. However, through word of mouth, I did land a few plum gigs. We can play this one that came about.
This is for the city of Cleveland. It's a promo for the city. And this is when the city was having New York envy. And you can tell it by the sound of the commercial and what they asked for.
What a plum,
Cleveland.
What a plum,
Cleveland.
First-rate choice, the sweetest. What a plum,
Cleveland. For theater music.
That's just, yeah?
Yeah.
And then this one is for the local news. And it played for years and years and years. And most people ignore the sound of local news. But I'd like to pay attention to a few things here. It's lush, yet not grandiose or obtrusive. A lot of things to writing a news broadcast music. Sense of movement. There's a pop ensemble with lush strings and horns. However, there's a Moog synthesizer because we're groovy at Channel 5. And young and on top of it. And there's also the Shaft wah-wah guitar in there, which always makes you groovy in this period. What was this, the 70s?
Something like that.
Yeah, Daddy was using early synthesizers. You might have heard this. This is their Catch 5 thing. Hear the expansiveness of it.
Mm-hmm.
here's the end of the note. There's the Moog.
So what I found was that if I could drive a few miles, I became an expert and had some nice success, mostly in the near Midwest. I tried to make lots and lots of car dealers and banks seem lovable.
Our house, most people grow up in their house hearing Frank Sinatra or whatever their parents were playing. These days it was the Beatles. But I knew every car dealer in the whole region and every bank. This one, Daddy said, you want to tell them what happens with these people's kids in this town? The kids drove them crazy because they wouldn't stop singing this.
Oh, yeah. That's I used the old Frère Jacques routine on this one. And when I went back to Columbus after it went on the air a month or so, I had friends come up and say, we're going to kill you. Our kids are driving us nuts singing that thing. And I said, yes.
Well, remember my point. Making a happy association is not nearly as important as being memorable.
Right. So. Len Emke Buick was...
OMB has a new thing going. Master Charge, Master Charge. Come and see why we can't stop.
Master Charge was a new product. No one heard of it yet.
Master Charge, OMB has a new thing going. Master Charge, Master Charge. Come and see why we can't stop growing. Master Charge, Master Charge. The fun way to fire. Everyone ought to try.
I put that in to show I'd gone to college.
This one is for a car dealership, and this does very specific things for a car dealership. Can I tell them about that?
Sure.
It says it's a special place. It's smooth and lush. You can trust these people. You'll be well treated. When you bring your car in, of course, if it's a lemon, they'll take good care of you. This was the day of the flugelhorn pop music sound. So it's got the flugelhorn sound, and you'll hear your composer here on a trombone solo. And as in most car dealerships, you had to find a way to get the address of the dealership in there.
There's a special place.
It's a very Burt Bacharach kind of sound people want.
Like that. That also was a wonderful entree because Len Emke, his dealership is just east of the State Building in Columbus, and between the State Building and Emke was the first Wendy's. And Len Emke and Dave Thomas and our then Governor Rhodes were all partners in the startup of the Wendy's business. And it led me to the opportunity to do...
Well, let's do that one next time.
We can do that next if
you like. This is the first Wendy's jingle.
First ever.
When Wendy's was in Columbus.
Dave Thomas looked over my shoulder while he made me eat that square hamburger and a bowl of chili and French fries and a Frosty, you know.
Very local advertiser stuff. He had to believe in the product.
Absolutely.
According to Dave Thomas.
Yep.
So here's the first Wendy's jingle.
Wendy's is a place you ought to know.
Youth culture.
Wendy's is a place for you to go.
Cause you won't know what you're missing till you're reminiscing at Wendy's.
For everybody.
There's old-fashioned flavor in everything you savor at Wendy's.
I like these words.
Originality and cordiality, most of all the food. You're gonna love it. Come on in, we'll demonstrate.
And it goes back to the rock stuff at the end. It donuts back to it. Okay. And remember, MasterCard was a brand new product. No one had ever heard of ATM machines. I sang on an ATM commercial. We didn't know what it was. Mm-hmm. They didn't even know what to call it yet. So he solved that problem by using Harold Hill patter to get all this information in an authoritative voice that middle America will go to the bank. So are you hearing okay? Sung by
Cliff Bemis, who was...
Cliff from IHOP.
He started out in Cleveland. Spokesman for years.
I sang a lot of jingles with Cliff. Here we go. You ready?
Master Plan is a faster plan to make your money move around. It's 12 handy ways your money pays and moves all over town. Master Plan is the faster plan, and it's only from MBT. Get Master Charge, it isn't hard, and you get Master Plan free. Monroe Bank and Trust checks are good at lots of stores, and Master Plan means much, much more. Because with Master Plan, you can even use the 724. You can pay your bills and even your loans, your heat, your light, and your telephone. You can borrow cash on any old day if you overdraw. Master Charge pays. Master Plan is a faster plan to make your money.
Look at all that information they had to give the consumer.
If you want a Master Plan, MBT's the only bank in town.
Deposit, withdraw, get cash. Put a little something in your private stash.
Any old hour of the day or night, hey, MBT's gonna treat you right.
Then I got a few national accounts.
Well, let's finish Pontiac Giants.
Oh, I'm sorry.
This broke the rule about humor, but humor is used well because their name is grandiose. It's Pontiac Giants. You can't go straight up the middle with Giants. People won't like you. So they use the humor to get the name of the client in there in a self-effacing manner.
Pontiac Giants!
Got a question for you. How can you tell a Pontiac Giant from an ordinary dealer?
By its four-foot-long boots.
Right! Look for the giant boots in the showroom window.
I think you're serious.
Get a giant.
Why would you rather buy a car from a Pontiac Giant?
There would be plenty of headroom.
No, because Pontiac Giants are so big and so powerful they can stock more Pontiacs and sell more Pontiacs for less.
A friendly giant.
Why does a Pontiac Giant have such big boots?
Because his feet are extremely ticklish.
No, so he can stomp down prices on new.
Do you recognize
Pontiac
that voiceover? That's Frank J. He did many commercials in town. Did anybody here recognize that voiceover voice? Frank did a lot of local stuff, didn't he? Yeah. Okay, now.
I would say play some of those nationals, maybe, huh?
Yeah, you ready to play nationals? Okay, this led to national accounts.
To my knowledge, the only nationals that were ever produced in the Cleveland area. Take a little pride in that.
Now, we're getting into the early points. Remember the points I made about successful jingles and imagination. Listen to Mayflower and Valvoline. We may have to have a little more volume on these. I don't know. And listen to where this takes your imagination. For a moving. Anybody here ever moved? Is it fun or adventurous or lovely? Okay, and how exciting is motor oil? Okay, but listen how we're selling these. From the distance and again in the distance. That romantic moving experience. And here, this is my favorite romantic treatment of motor oil, I think, ever, Daddy.
There's a feeling, America, that makes you want to move and explore the adventure of summer. You at the wheel, alive with the sunshine of experience. And every mile along the way, you're assured that your engine's running smooth and cool, thanks to the protection of Valvoline, the motor oil that prevents heat buildup and lets you experience the adventure of freedom.
Valvoline. And what was the only lyric she sang? Right. You can just read what this is. Yep. And then here's another one, not unlike the OMB and Oscar Mayer Wieners in that category.
Stanley, Stanley, what a pal you are. You open up my garage door while I stay inside my car.
George, why are you singing?
Just telling Stanley I appreciate him. You know, Stanley.
And that's, of course, a famous tune. Daisy, Daisy. Okay.
This work led eventually to more ambitious challenges, industrial film scores and audiovisuals, trade shows, and finally into scores for SeaWorld. It seems I became known as the good music guy, meaning that I guess that I brought my traditional schooling and experience to orchestration, conducting, and general performance into play in the creative process. I did and do believe that musical basics are still the best way. A good melodic line and strong harmonies are better learned and remembered by listeners, a major goal of most commercial music. I don't know how much time you have for the rest of this.
Well, we'll just keep going. Let's listen to this. This is the SeaWorld montage.
And some of the later things.
Yeah, this is, SeaWorld was local. You know, there's a local SeaWorld here. And at first they bought this just for the local SeaWorld, and they used it at all the shows. I got to sing the Shamu Love Ballet. That was my favorite thing.
Come with me, sail out to sea with a hale and hearty crew. Oh, come along, they're big and strong and they're waiting just for you. And it's yo, out to the sea we go and we'll open up.
Swimming whales? Big orchestra, big budget. I was so young.
Let's play together.
A little nepotism.
We'll be friends forever.
It helps if she's a hell of a singer.
So this is a cut above stuff you hear at Disneyland and theme parks. This is real music.
The sea, beautiful, magnificent, alive, and still one of the world's most captivating mysteries. Come with SeaWorld into the domain where you are the intruder. Journey into the depths of the ocean, where man becomes one of many animals, and where one is supreme. The shark.
That was Alexander Scorby. Some of you will remember that voice.
You want to keep reading?
Sure. Okay. Mechanics of working in Cleveland. The only real 24-track studio in town was Cleveland Recording on Euclid Avenue's what is known as Playhouse Square. I did a jingle for Playhouse Square, too. It was a decent studio, though not a great room. The studio moved a few blocks. It was a better space, but in 77, the owner split and the studio moved way out of town to the east under the name Summa. I did sessions there, but soon began to assemble an electronic home music studio in the basement of our house. Since Cleveland was not a recording center, I had to develop my own core of players who became skilled at the requirements of studio playing, which are often quite different from live performance. Bob Fraser became a genius on fretted instruments. He played electric bass, guitars, banjos, anything. There were a couple of fine drummers, keyboards, brass and woodwinds, and often strings. The latter, depending on budget restrictions, ranged from three violins up to large sections of 20 or more. With the larger groups, I mixed Cleveland Orchestra members with my more commercially savvy pit orchestra friends, and the sense of competition was palpable. They were each going to show how much better they were than each other. Where am I?
Last line of the page.
Okay. We utilized multi-tracking, overdubbing different parts and doubling some, thus making big sounding tracks often from a surprisingly small group. I often saved a buck trying to play all the trombone parts myself. Similarly, I assembled a number of singers and worked with them in becoming capable session performers. Cliff was one, Amy is another. Some were chosen for their quick learning ability, natural sense of rhythm and pitch, but who often did not read music. Others, including your clinician, were more well-rounded, trained, and could read and work quickly. I often combined the two types to obtain the right mix of feel versus consistency and accuracy. Again, we often overdubbed to get large choruses from a handful of singers. Amy wanted to tell a story.
Yeah, there's one little story I remember. We had Cleveland Orchestra players in there. It was a big session, a lot of money. And this was before, this is in Cleveland when they didn't know how to work in a studio. And so one stand, he wasn't hearing well. Daddy doesn't remember this story. He might have blocked it out. I was 18. I'll never forget it. I was waiting to sing. And he said, "We can't hear you. Third violins, move closer." They moved closer to the stand, but further from the microphone. So he asked to move, and again, they moved closer to the stand, but further from the microphone. Finally, he just said, "Well, just get your F-hole up there." And he really meant that. But one of the women, of course, the guys who were the session players started to laugh, and then it all snowballed, and one of the women from the Cleveland Orchestra just very quietly put her violin in the case, zipped it up, and went home. That was that. So she had enough of commercial recording. We're going to finish. This was just a short little bit of what it's like to be a composer in a limited market. There are literally hundreds of one-minute masterpieces that Dick Woolley has composed over his career, and some larger pieces at all, too. But we're going to finish with what I call Patio Enclosures Redux, because eventually, after about 20 years of them using the fifth generation dub of patio enclosures, and it just sounded awful, he convinced them to spend a few hundred dollars to redo it again. So this is all done with his DX7, his very first DX7 studio in his home, when it was like the beginning of electronic music. So you can hear all the DX7s. And we will close with Patio Enclosures Redux. And by the way, I heard this on the radio in the local station, or on the local television station in Virginia. The shorter version. This is very experimental days with all DX7s.
There's a way to find a brand new season, rain or snow or shine. It's the season you've been looking for, because it's summer all the time. And someone new
I hit it that time. Take a couple. We started 15 minutes late, so even though we're just about on time, we don't have time for a lot of questions to try and catch up. Anybody have any questions?
Yes.
Yeah, that was a product. It was anybody remember 50-50? Yeah, what is it? Tell them what it is. Lemon, lime, and grapefruit soda. It was really good.
Oh, it's really 50-50, a wonderful drink, or something like that. I don't know.
Any others?
Yeah, no, that was a drink.
50-50 was a product of Canfield's, and I guess maybe they marketed it.
Exactly.
Really?
Yeah.
Canfield's is a Chicago bottler.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Yep.
Yeah.
Are your jingles getting shorter?
Shorter? We were always restricted pretty much to the 60s, 30s, and 10s. We call the 10s IDs, sometimes a little shorter than that.
He doesn't compose so many jingles now because it's the market's changed. That last thing was the beginning of when he did that last Patio Enclosures, that was the beginning of a whole new topic on how jingles are being made, with guys just sitting there just in there playing them on synths in their homes.
Like much music. Commercial music.
Not a question, but I'm one of the people who has a career elsewhere, but I'm a local Clevelander, and so I grew up hearing everyone who's jingles. I find myself singing them at odd times in odd ways, and Vishniac and all those things. It's so much more interesting to hear them in fidelity rather than out of those little 3-inch car speakers.
Yeah. Vishniac Black Cherry, you remember that?
Any others? Thank you very much. Okay, we're going to have to, you want to talk while I get my thing shut down?
Thank you very much to Amy and Dick for that wonderful presentation.